Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Columbia Pictures. Castle Rock Entertainment. In association with Nelson Entertainment, presents a Rob Reiner film. An unsmoked cigarette rests beside a matchstick. Nearby, a figure's working at a typewriter. An empty champagne flute sits an arm's reach away, and a bottle of bubbly remains untouched, but on ice. The end of a sentence is typed. Without it, what else was there? The writer, a dark-haired man, removes the sheet of paper and scans it. He places the page on top of a small pile and writes the end in pencil under the final paragraph. He then turns the page over, neatens up the stack, adds it to a larger one and tidies this before staring at the cover sheet. Untitled by Paul Sheldon. The draft is slipped into a battered leather holder before Paul pours out a glass of champagne and considers his cigarette. He pops it into his mouth, snaps his thumb on the match and lights up, savouring that first inhalation of smoke. The leather holder's dropped onto the passenger seat of a sleek black car outside Paul's snow-covered mountain retreat. He scoops snow off the bonnet and hurls a ball of it at a nearby pine tree.
Still got it.
His black car cruises along a mountain road blanketed with snow. Misery. James Caan. Kathy Bates. Francis Sternhagen and Richard Farnsworth as Buster. Special appearance by Lauren Bacall. Music by Mark Shaman. Starts to fall on the already deep powder. He turns on the windscreen wipers and continues on his way. The snow is falling harder, obscuring Paul's view of the road. Based on the novel Misery by Stephen King. A road sign warns of a snaking bend up ahead. The car loses grip on the snow and begins to weave from side to side. He slaps a hand down on his draft and completely loses control of the car. It plows off the road and rolls over several times down a slope. It eventually comes to a stop on its roof. A flashback to Paul sitting in an office, holding the battered leather satchel.
What's that?
An old friend. I was rummaging through a closet and just sitting there.
It's nice, Paul. It's got character.
When I wrote my first book, I used to carry it around in this while I was looking for a publisher. I was a writer then.
You're still a writer.
I haven't been a writer since I got in the misery business.
Not a bad business. And it would still be growing, too. The first printing for Misery's Child was the most ever. Over a million.
Marcia, please.
Misery Chastain put braces on your daughter's teeth and is putting her through college. Bought you two houses and floor seats to the Knicks. And what thanks does she get? You go and kill her.
I never meant for it to become my life. And if I hadn't gotten rid of her now, I'd have ended up writing her forever.
Now I'm leaving for Colorado to try to finish the new book.
If I can make this work, I might just have something I want on my tombstone.
In the car, a bloody Paul passes out. Someone's working a crowbar into the crack of the door, trying to open it. They manage to prise the door open. The figure thrusts the crowbar into the ground before hauling Paul out. With Paul now clear of the car, the figure starts giving him mouth to mouth. She presses on his chest, and after a few rounds of CPR, manages to revive him. The figure picks up the leather case and stashes it inside their jacket. They pick up the crowbar and then hoist Paul over their shoulders. Steadying themselves with the crowbar, the figure carries Paul away. Later, in a bedroom, Paul comes to.
I'm your number one fan. There is nothing to worry about. You're gonna be just fine. I'll take good care of you. I'm your number one fan.
A motherly-looking middle-aged woman looks down at Paul's battered and bruised face.
Where?
We're just outside Silver Creek.
How long?
You've been here 2 days. You're gonna be okay. My name is Annie Wilkes.
My number one fan.
Yes, that's right. I'm also a nurse. Here, take these.
She pushes two tablets into his mouth and helps him sip some water. Sometime later, Annie pulls an IV out of Paul's hand and places a plaster on the wound. She goes over to the other side of the bed and takes two more tablets out of a blister pack.
Here.
What are they?
They're called Novril. They're for your pain.
He takes them, and she holds his head up so he can have some water.
Thank you.
She dabs a flannel on his forehead.
I come from that hospital.
The blizzard was too strong. I couldn't risk trying to get you there. I tried calling, but the phone lines are down.
Could you?
Oh, you mustn't tire yourself. You've got to rest. You almost died.
More time passes. Annie feeds Paul more tablets.
Open wide. Your legs just sing grand opera when you move, don't they? It's not gonna hurt forever, Paul, I promise you.
Will I be able to walk?
Of course you will. And your arm will be fine, too. Your shoulder was pretty badly dislocated. It was a little stubborn, but I finally popped it back in. What I'm most proud of is the work I did on those legs. Considering what I had around the house, I don't think there's a doctor who could have done any better. It's not nearly as bad as it looks. You have a compound fracture of the tibia in both legs, and the fibula in the right leg is fractured, too. I could hear the bones moving, so it's best for your legs to remain immobile. And as soon as the road's open, I'll take you to a hospital. In the meantime, you've got a lot of recovering to do. And I consider it an honor that you'll do it in my home.
In Paul's agent's office.
This is Marcia Sandell. I'm calling from New York City. I'd like to speak to the Silver Creek chief of police or sheriff.
Which one of them do you want?
Whichever one's not busy.
Well, I'm pretty sure they're both not busy, Miss Sandell, since they're both me.
I also happen to be president of the Policeman's Benefit Association,
chairman of the Patrolman's Retirement Fund, and if you need a good fishing guide, you could do a lot worse. Call me Buster. Everybody does.
What can I do for you?
I'm a literary. I think one of my clients, Paul Sheldon, might be in some kind of trouble.
You mean Paul Sheldon, the writer?
Uh-huh.
He's your client, huh?
Yes, he is.
Well, everybody sure likes those misery books.
Yeah. I'm sure you know that Paul's been coming to the Silver Creek Lodge for years to finish his books.
I understand he's been up here the last 6 weeks.
Not quite.
I just called there, and they said he checked out last Tuesday. Isn't that a little strange?
Oh, I don't know. Does he usually phone you before he checks out of a hotel?
No. No, of course not. It's just that his daughter hasn't heard from him, and when he has a new book coming out, he usually keeps in touch.
Now, when there wasn't any word from him,
You think he might be missing, huh?
I hate that I made this call. Tell me I'm being silly.
Oh, a little overprotective, maybe, but tell you what I'll do. Nothing's been reported out here, but I'll put his name through our system. If anything turns up, I'll call you right back.
Oh, I'd appreciate that. Thanks a lot.
Goodbye, Miss Sandell.
We got a phone call. Busy morning.
Yeah, work, work, work. Virginia, when was that blizzard?
Last Tuesday. Why?
No reason.
Buster stuck a sticky label with Paul's name on onto a pinboard. Annie is shaving Paul's face with a cutthroat razor.
I guess it was kind of a miracle you finding me.
No, it wasn't a miracle at all. In a way, I was following you.
You were following me?
Well, it wasn't any secret to me you were staying at the Silver Creek, seeing as how I'm your number one fan and all. Some nights I just tool on down there and sit outside and look up at the light in your cabin, and I try to imagine what was going on in the room of the world's greatest writer.
Say the last part again, I didn't hear you.
Don't move now. Wouldn't want to hurt this neck. Well, the other afternoon, I was on my way home, and there you were, leaving the lodge. And I wondered why a literary genius would go for a drive when there was a big storm coming.
I didn't know there was a big storm coming.
Well, lucky for you, I did. Lucky for me, too, because now you're alive, and you can write more books. Oh, Paul, I've read everything of yours, but the misery novels. I know them all by heart, all 8 of them. I love them so.
You're very kind.
And you're very brilliant. Like a baby. All done.
Thank you. When do you think the phone lines will be up? I have to call my daughter, and I'd like to call my agent in New York and let her know I'm still breathing.
Shouldn't be too much longer now. Once the roads are open, the phone lines will be up in no time. Yeah. If you give me their numbers, I'll keep trying them for you.
Thank you.
Could I ask you a favor? I noticed in your case there's a new Paul Sheldon book, and I wondered if maybe...
You want to read it?
If you wouldn't mind...
I do have a very hard and fast rule as to who reads my stuff at this early stage. Only my editor, my agent, and anybody that saves me from freezing to death in a car wreck.
Oh.
Annie picks up the draft with a smile.
You'll never realize what a rare treat you've given me. Boy, it's like clockwork the way your pain comes. I'll get you your novel, Paul. Forgive me for prattling away and making you feel all oogie. What's your new book called?
I don't have a title yet.
What's it about?
I don't know. I know it sounds crazy, but I haven't written anything but misery for so long. wanted you to... And you can tell me what you think it's about. Maybe you can come up with a title.
Like I could do that.
Nothing unusual about Mr. Sheldon's leaving, Buster. You can tell by the champagne.
Maybe you can, Libby.
See, he always orders a bottle of Dom Perignon when he's ready to go. Then he pays up and he's out the door.
No long-distance phone calls or Federal Express packages. Anything out of the ordinary?
I don't think Mr. Sheldon likes for things to be out of the ordinary. Considering who he is and all famous and all, he doesn't put on airs. Drives up from New York in the same car each time. 65 Mustang. Says it helps him to think. He's always been a good guest. Never makes a noise, never bothers a soul. I sure hope nothing's happened to him.
So do I.
I bet that old Mustang is pulling into New York right now.
I'm sure you're right. Thanks, Libby.
My pleasure.
At the house, Annie's feeding Paul soup from a bowl.
I know I'm only 40 pages into your book, but...
But what?
Nothing.
What is it?
What's ridiculous? Who am I to make a criticism to someone like you?
It's all right, I can take it.
Well, it's brilliantly written, but then everything you write is brilliant.
Pretty rough so far.
The swearing, Paul. There, I said it.
The profanity bothers you.
It has no nobility.
These are slum kids. I was a slum kid. Everybody talks like that.
They do not? What do you think I say when I go to the feed store in town? Oh, now, Wally, give me a bag of that effing pig feed and 10 pounds of that bitchly cow corn. And in the bank, do I tell Mrs. Bollinger, oh, here's one big bastard of a check. Give me some of your Christing money. There, look there. See what you made me do?
She spilt some soup on the bed.
Oh, Paul, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Oh, sometimes I get so worked up. Can you ever forgive me?
Fine.
I love you, Paul. Your mind, your creativity, that's all I meant.
He smiles curtly, and she flusters for a moment before carrying out the tray of food. He looks around the room, his face betraying a sense of slight unease. Outside, the weather's improved, but there's still deep snow on the ground. Virginia's driving Buster's police car and slowly rounds a corner. It comes to the same section of road as where Paul had his accident.
Well, it sure is fun.
As Buster sips a drink, Virginia starts rubbing his knee.
Virginia, when you're in this car, you're not my wife, you're my deputy.
Well, this deputy'd rather be home under the covers with the sheriff.
Stop.
What?
Stop!
What?
Buster and Virginia get out of the car. He spotted a broken tree at the side of the road.
See that broken limb?
Could have been the weight of the snow.
Yeah, could have been a rotten branch. Could have been the wind. Could have been a lot of things.
Buster makes his way down the steep, snow-covered slope, occasionally losing his footing. He looks down at the slope, but only sees a freshly fallen layer of snow in the edge of a forest. He continues a little further, but suddenly falls waist deep into some soft snow.
Need some help?
No, I'm enjoying myself. Thank you.
He climbs out and heads back towards Virginia, failing to see the tires of the upturned car a few feet further down the slope.
You really think Sheldon's out there?
I hope not. If he is, he's dead. Let's go to the newspaper office.
As they head back towards the car, Annie drives past in the opposite direction. Paul stirs from his sleep and looks up to see the door handle slowly turning. The door opens and Annie pokes her head in.
Oh, I hope I didn't wake you.
No, that's fine.
Look what I got. They had it at the store, Paul. There was a whole batch of them there. And as soon as I saw it, I slammed my money down. I got the first copy.
And the roads are open.
Well, the one to town is, but that's about it. I called the hospital, and I talked to the head orthopedic surgeon, and I told him who you were and what had happened. And he said as long as there's no infection, you're not in any danger. And as soon as the road to the hospital is open, they'll send an ambulance for you.
The phone's working.
Well, mine's still out, but the ones in town were working just fine. I called that agent of yours. Oh, Paul, I peeked at the very beginning. What a wonderful first page. Just to read the name Misery Chastain.
My daughter's gotta be going nuts.
It's like a visit from my oldest, dearest
friend.
She's
supposed to be home for her birthday. It's today.
The agent said she would tell her you were okay, but I'm afraid you'll have to wait till tomorrow if you want to talk to her yourself. Oh, Paul, what a poet you are.
Later, she brings him a plate of food.
I made you my specialty, scrambled eggs a la Wilkes. And I'm on page 75.
I guess that means it's okay.
No. No, it isn't. It's... Oh, poo. I can't think of any words. Would great be insulting?
I can live with great.
No, it's not just great, it's perfect. A perfect, perfect thing.
Outside, the river is thawed and the snow is starting to melt. Sunlight streams into Paul's bedroom from a nearly perfect blue sky. The door opens and a pig trots in. It puts its front trotters up on the bed and sniffs Paul.
I thought it was time you two should meet. Paul, say hello to my favorite beast in the whole world, my sow, Misery.
Misery.
Yes, I told you I was your number one fan.
Yeah, I'm starting to believe you.
This farm was kind of dreary with just a few cows and chickens and me. But when I got Misery here, everything changed. She just makes me smile so.
She's a fine pig is what she is.
I'm on page 300 now, Paul. And it's better than perfect. It's divine. What's the ceiling that Dago painted?
The Sistine Chapel.
Yeah, that and Misery's Child. Those are the only two divine things ever in this world.
Annie oinks at Paul and chases Misery out of the room. Now, Annie's staring out of the window at the snowy landscape.
When my husband left me, I wasn't prepared. It wasn't an easy time. For a while, I thought I might go crazy.
Yeah, I know how that can be.
I don't know about you, but what I did to get through it was I dove into work. Days, nights. Night shifts can be lonely at a hospital. I did a lot of reading. That was when I first discovered Misery. She made me so happy. She made me forget all my problems. Of course, I suppose you had a little something to do with that, too.
Yeah, well.
I just kept reading them over and over. I've only got two chapters to go on this one, and I know when I finish, I'll just turn right to the first page and start reading it all over again.
Done? Yeah.
No problem.
Thanks.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not against marriage per se, but it'd take a pretty special guy to make me want to walk down that aisle again.
Yeah, it's not something you should enter into lightly.
It boils down to respect. People just don't respect the institution of marriage anymore. They have no sense of real commitment. Well, I'd love to stay here and chat, but I'm right at the end, and I gotta find out what happens.
Annie leaves Paul alone in bed. Later, the moon has risen and night has fallen over Annie's cabin. Paul's woken from his sleep.
You dirty bird. How could you? She can't be dead. Misery Chastain cannot be dead.
Annie, in 1871, women often died in childbirth. But her spirit is the important thing, and Misery's spirit is still alive.
I don't want her dead! I want her! And you murdered her!
No, I didn't.
Who did?
No one. She died. She just slipped away.
Slipped away? Slipped away? She didn't just slip away! You did it! You did it! You murdered my Misery!
Annie!
She smashes a table against the wall.
I thought you were good, Paul. But you're not good. You're just another lying old dirty birdie. And I don't think I'd better be around you for a while.
She goes to the door before turning back to look at him.
Don't even think about anybody coming for you. Not the doctors, not your agent, not your family. Because I never called them. Nobody knows you're here. And you better hope nothing happens to me. Because if I die, you die.
He looks out the window and sees her car rolling away from the cabin. He picks up a piece of the table from above his head and hurls it across the room. His attention is drawn to the door across the room from his bed. He leans out over the side of the bed and presses a hand against the hard wooden floor. He pulls himself out a little further before looking back at his legs with an anxious expression. With one final effort, he pulls himself out of the bed and his legs fall to the floor. Using his arms, he hauls himself forward, dragging his useless legs behind him. pushes away a piece of the broken table, flinging it across the room. His face contorted with concentration and effort, he edges nearer the door. He stares up at the handle and pulls himself the last few feet to the door. He reaches up and twists the handle, but the door's locked. Buster's on the phone, looking at a newspaper article about Paul's disappearance.
No, Miss Sindel, there's no point in coming up here now. Everything that can be done is. Yes, we're working close with the state police and the FBI's been informed. Right. Right. As soon as we know anything, we'll let you know. No bother at all. Call any time. Goodbye, Miss Sindel.
All right. Well, I sure appreciate it. Thank you. According to the check on Sheldon's credit charges, there's nothing after the Silver Creek.
And no calls about the article either.
You poor dear thing. What are you doing on the floor? It's all my fault. I'd had a proper hospital bed, this never would have happened. Here, let me help you back in. I know this hurts. It'll only take a few seconds. Okay. Oh, sit, Daisy.
Oh. Oh, please. Wait.
Oh, you're such a crybaby.
Wait.
There you go. Comfy?
Perfect.
You're such a kidder. I have a big surprise for you. But first, there's something you must do.
You don't suppose I could have a little snack while I'm waiting for the surprise?
I'll get you everything you want, but you must listen first. Sometimes my thinking is a little muddy. I accept that. That's why I couldn't remember all the things they were asking me on the witness stand in Denver. But this time, I thought clearly. I asked God about you, and God said, I delivered him unto you so that you may show him the way.
Show me the way.
Yes.
She wheels a barbecue into the room and pulls off the lid to reveal Paul's draft. She takes the papers out of their leather folder and places them down on the grill. He looks on calmly as she squirts lighter fluid over the top two pages.
When I mentioned a snack, I was thinking more along the lines of cheese and crackers kind of thing.
Paul, this is no time for jokes. You must rid the world of this filth.
You want me to burn my book?
I know this may be difficult for you, but it's for the best.
It's really not difficult at all. My agent made dozens of copies. There's going to be an auction in New York. Every publishing house in New York is reading it now. So if you want me to burn my book, fine. You're not really ridding the world of anything.
Then light the match, Paul.
It's no big deal.
So you've indicated. Do it.
She holds out a match in its box.
I know this is the only copy, Paul. When you were 24, you wrote your first book and you didn't make a copy because you didn't think anybody would take it seriously. But they did, and ever since, you've never made any copies because you're superstitious. That's why you always come back to the Silver Creek Lodge. You told that story to Merv Griffin 11 years ago.
Merv Griffin. I'll tell you what. It doesn't ever have to be published. No one ever has to read it. I'll just keep it for myself. No one will even know it exists.
As long as it does exist, your mind won't ever be free. I think you should light the match, Paul.
She slips the match between his finger and thumb.
Can't you see it's what God wants? You're so brilliant, I would think you'd certainly be able to see that.
She squirts lighter fuel on the bed.
We're put on this earth to help people, Paul. Like I'm trying to help you. Please, help me help you.
His brow furrowed with sadness, he slowly lights the match. He stares at the flame.
You're doing the right thing. Oh, my goodness! Goodness gracious! Oh, my!
Having thrown the match on the barbecue, the manuscript starts to burn. He stares into the fire as she fetches a bucket of water and douses the flames.
Well, isn't that an oogie mess?
She starts to wheel the smoking barbecue out of the room. A helicopter's approaching. Buster's on board.
That's the Stedman place down there. And that's the Wilkes farm straight ahead. That's no 65 Mustang. Well, there's nothing else out this way. Let's circle back.
Annie watches the helicopter from her window.
I do believe the winters are getting shorter and shorter every year. People say it has something to do with the ozone layer. What do you think?
I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's a theory.
She slips a tablet into his hand.
Here's your novel.
And takes back the matches. She wheels the barbecue out of the room. Left alone, Paul looks down at the two orange tablets in his hand. He slips them between the mattress and the sheets. A television's on in Annie's bedroom.
All right, we're back now. You're going to have to remind us who the audience chose.
They chose Kevin.
They chose Kevin. Yeah. He's backstage. Say hello to Kevin Andrews. Hi, Kevin. Hi, how you doing, Chuck?
Fine. Make yourself at home back there.
Hi, Sherry. Sherry, tell us about the date.
Okay. First of all, I picked out a very classy restaurant.
Did
it
you?
Was so classy. And he shows up without no tie. No, and he has...
Annie's watching the TV in bed, gorging on crisps and a bottle of cola. In his room, Paul is finishing his dessert. Annie has placed two red tablets on a crochet doily next to Paul's food. He cleans his fork with a napkin and uses it to cut open the side of his mattress. He takes the tablets and slips them through the small incision.
See, isn't this nice?
Great. I always wanted to visit the other side of the room.
Ooh, and look what I got for you. Oh, an electric razor. So you can shave yourself now.
If I knew this was going to be the surprise, I'd have burned all my books.
Now, don't poke fun. This is a very big day for you, Paul. You just sit tight, and I'll set everything up.
Set what up?
That's the big surprise. your new studio. After all, writers do need a place to work.
Work? You mean write? What in the world do you think I'd write?
Oh, but Paul, I don't think. I know. Now that you've gotten rid of that nasty manuscript, you can go back to doing what you're great at. You're gonna write a new novel. Your greatest achievement ever. Misery's Return.
Misery's Return?
I know you didn't mean it when you killed her, and now you'll make it right. It'll be a book in my honor for saving your life and nursing you back to health. Oh, Paul, you're gonna make me the envy of the whole world.
You just expect me to whip something off, is that it?
I expect nothing less than your masterpiece.
You do understand that this is not the ordinary way in which books get written. I mean, some people might actually consider this an oddball situation.
I have total confidence in your brilliance. Besides, the view will inspire you. You just inhale that. I'll be right back.
As she goes out, he spots a hairpin on the floor.
I guess you don't get bothered by neighbors much.
Don't you worry about that. You'll have total solitude so you can concentrate on your work.
Great.
I got you this expensive paper to type on, and I got a great deal on this 50-pound clunker on account of its missing an N. I told the sales lady N was one of the letters in my favorite writer's name.
It's two of the letters in my favorite nurse's name, Annie.
You fooler. Did I do good?
You did great. There is just one little thing. I can't work on this paper. See, it's graspable bond and it smudges. So I thought maybe if you went back into town, you could bring me some white long grain Mimeo.
But mine cost the most, so I don't see how it can smudge.
Come here, I'll show you.
He rolls some of the paper into the typewriter and types out the word smudge. He rubs his finger on the word, smudging the ink. Annie tries it herself.
Oh, it does smudge after all. Isn't that fascinating?
I thought you'd be interested. I'd like for you to be in on everything, Annie, not just the finished book, but how it's written.
Thank you for thinking of me. Anything else I can get while I'm in town? Any other crucial requirements that need satisfying? Would you like a tiny tape recorder? Or how about a handmade set of writing slippers?
Well, just the paper will be fine.
Are you sure? Because if you want, I'll bring back the whole store for you.
Annie, what's the matter?
What's the matter? I'll tell you what's the matter. I go out of my way for you. I do everything to try and make you happy. I feed you, I clean you, I dress you, and what thanks do I get? Oh, you bought the wrong paper, Annie. I can't write on this paper, Annie. Well, I'll get your stupid paper, but you just better start showing me a little more appreciation around here, Mr. Man.
She slams the paper down onto his lap. He clenches his fist and grinds his teeth in agony. Annie drives off in her station wagon. Seeing she's gone, he pulls his right arm out of its sling and tests its movement. He grimaces as he raises it slightly. He slowly wheels himself over to the hairpin and reaches over to pick it up. With the pin just in his reach, he eventually manages to pick it up between his fingers. He rolls over to the door and positions his chair parallel with the lock. Having removed the pin from between his teeth, He bends it and works it into the lock. He drops it.
Shit.
He reaches over the side of the chair and picks the pin up. He slips the hairpin back into the lock.
Come on, you've written about this, not the wit.
He's taken by surprise when the door unlocks.
Well, you know what actually works.
He struggles to maneuver the wheelchair and his legs out of the way, but he manages to swing the door open and push himself through it. He looks up and down the hallway and back up towards the front door. He turns the handle, but the door is locked. He opens the door of the living room and pushes himself in. Across the room, he spots a black telephone sitting on a table next to two framed photographs. He quickly wheels himself towards the phone and picks up the receiver. He picks the phone up and finds it's just a shell with no internal workings. Annie's outside the store, having bought some new packets of paper. She gets back into her car and pulls away. There's still thick, sludgy snow on the ground. Paul makes his way across the living room, looking around with an anxious expression. His foot bumps into a table, knocking over an ornamental penguin, but he just catches it before it hits the ground. He places the figurine back on the table and continues across the room. Amongst some photos, he spots a scrapbook with the words Memory Lane embossed on the front. Nearby is the complete collection of misery books with a signed picture of Paul in front of them. He slowly makes his way back out into the hallway, looking nervously at the front door before positioning his chair next to the closet door. He knocks it open with the chair's footrest. On an upper shelf is a wide variety of tablets, including the red ones that Annie's been giving him. He picks up a packet and stashes it down his trousers. He's about to get a second packet when he thinks against it and reverses his chair back out the room. Annie's on her way back. Paul opens the kitchen door and looks around at the conservative, mundane surroundings. There's a back door across the room next to the fridge. He goes to wheel himself through the doorway, but the chair is too wide. He stares at the door and heaves his right leg next to his left. He lowers the right footrest and drops both legs onto the floor. Annie's behind the wheel of her car as Paul pulls himself across the floor of the kitchen. Ah. Having made it to the door, he rolls onto his back and reaches his hand up towards the handle. He twists it, but it doesn't open. He sits up and leans against the fridge. A resigned smile creeps across his face as he lets out a sigh. His attention is drawn to a knife block on a worktop. Hearing Annie's car rolling up the drive, Paul hauls himself back across the kitchen. He makes it back to his wheelchair as Annie's car draws ever nearer. His face contorted from the effort, he yanks himself back into the chair as Annie pulls up in front of the house. Wincing with pain, he pulls his legs back onto their rests. Annie picks up the paper and climbs out of the car. His face wet with perspiration, he speeds down the hallway as Annie trudges across the snow towards the front door. He's about to turn into the bedroom when he realizes the living room door is still open. He reverses back up and yanks it closed. Annie's coming up the stairs when she drops one of the packets of paper. As she bends down to pick it up, he rolls back into the bedroom. He fumbles in his tracksuit bottoms for the hairpin as she reaches for her keys. He slips the hairpin into the lock and works it around. He locks it just as she comes in through the front door. He stashes the pin back in his trousers along with a packet of tablets.
Pa, I've got your paper. I hope it's enough. 3 reams of long-grain menu. Just the kind you asked for. Paul, you're dripping with perspiration. Your color is very hectic. What have you been doing?
You know damn well what I've been doing. I've been sitting here suffering. I need my pills.
Poor dear. Let's get you back in bed and I'll get them for you.
I want my pills now.
It'll only take a second.
No! I want my pain to go away, Annie. Please. Make it go away. Please, Annie. Please.
It just breaks my heart to see you like this.
Paul's just managed to hide the packet of tablets which were poking out of the top of his trousers.
I've done a lot of thinking on the drive. Here you go. And I'm absolutely certain the main reason I've never been more popular is because of my temper. You must be so mad at me. The truth now.
Well, who doesn't let off a little steam every once in a while?
My genius needs his rest before he writes. Gypsy's up. There you go.
She lifts him back into bed and covers him with the sheets. She offers him a notepad and pencil.
Here. In case you think of any ideas.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't expect too much.
Don't be silly. You'll be brilliant. Think of me as your inspiration. I have faith in you, my darling. Catch this. Mwah!
He catches her air kiss with a forced smile. After she's gone, he takes the tablets out of his mouth and hides them in the mattress. Buster's back in the helicopter. As he flies over a bend in the road, something in the snow catches his eye. Looking through a pair of binoculars, he spots Paul's upturned car. Sometime later, the car car's being pulled out of the snow as a police chief speaks to a group of reporters.
The presumption must now be that Paul Sheldon is dead. We know that he somehow managed to crawl outside his vehicle, but we have been unable to find his body anywhere in the vicinity of the accident. We also know that if anyone had found him, they would have taken him to an area hospital. Undoubtedly, he is buried somewhere out there in the snow. We'll find him after the first thaw. That is, unless the animals didn't get to him first, which is a distinct possibility.
That was a statement from Colorado Police Chief Sherman Douglas.
Famed novelist Paul Sheldon.
We will be updating you with the...
Buster and Virginia are inspecting the marks on the door of the car.
You don't think he's dead, do you?
Well, he might well be, but not the way they say. He never crawled out of that car by himself. You see the dents on the door there? Someone pulled him out.
Paul's in his room, folding up a piece of paper. He's made a small packet and hides it under the covers. He breaks one of the tablets open and empties some of the powder out onto his finger.
Sorry, Paul, this is all wrong.
What?
You'll have to do it over again. It's not worthy of you. Throw it all out, except for that part of naming the gravedigger after me. You can leave that in.
I really value your criticism, but maybe we're being a little hasty here.
Paul, what you've written just isn't fair.
Not fair.
That's right. When I was growing up in Bakersfield, my favorite thing in all the world was to go to the movies on Saturday afternoons for the chapter plays.
Cliffhangers.
I know that, Mr. Man. They also call them serials. I'm not stupid, you know. Anyway, my favorite was Rocket Man. And once it was a no-brakes chapter. And the bad guy stuck him in a car on a mountain road, knocked him out, and welded the door shut, and tore out the brakes, and started him to his death. And he woke up and tried to steer and tried to get out, but the car went off a cliff before he could escape. And it crashed and burned, and I was so upset and excited. And the next week, you better believe I was first in line. And they always start with the end of the last week. And there was Rocket Man trying to get out. And here comes the cliff. And just before the car went off the cliff, he jumped free. And all the kids cheered. But I didn't cheer. I stood right up and started shouting, "This isn't what happened last week! Have you all got amnesia? They just cheated us! This isn't fair! He didn't get out of the cock-a-doody car!"
They always cheated like that in chapter plays.
But not you. Not with my misery. Remember, Ian did ride for Dr. Cleary at the end of the last book, but his horse fell jumping that fence, and Ian broke his shoulder and his ribs and lay all night in the ditch, and he never reached the doctor. So there couldn't have been any experimental blood transfusion that saved her life. Misery was buried in the ground at the end, Paul, so you'll have to start there.
Nighttime. A gentle sprinkling of snow is falling on the farm. By morning, there's a fresh, thick layer of snow on the ground. Annie's with Paul, reading some of his work.
Is it fair? Should I continue?
You better. Oh, Paul. When Ian realized that the reason they'd buried Misery alive was because the beasting had put her in that temporary coma. And when Gravedigger Wilkes remembered how 30 years earlier the same thing had happened to Lady Evelyn Hyde. Oh, and then old Dr. Cleary deduced that Misery must be Lady Evelyn Hyde's long-lost daughter because of the rarity of deadly beastings, my heart just leapt! I've known from the very first book that Misery had to be born of nobility, and I was right.
Yeah.
Oh, Paul, can I read each chapter when you finish? I can fill in the ends. Will she be her old self now that Ian has dug her out, or will she have amnesia?
I have to wait.
Will she still love him with that special, perfect love?
You'll have to wait.
Not even a hint?
Mm-mm.
Oh, Misery's alive! Misery's alive! Oh, it's so romantic! Oh, this whole house is gonna be filled with romance! I'm gonna put on my Liberace records. You do like Liberace, don't you?
Whenever we played Radio City, who do you think was right there in the front row?
I'm gonna play my records all day long to inspire you. He's my all-time favorite.
Annie. Would you have dinner with me tonight to celebrate Misery's return? I couldn't have done it without you.
Oh, Paul. Would be an honor.
At the sheriff's office, Virginia's on the phone.
No, he's not here. I don't know where he is. He never tells me anything anymore. He's probably out having an affair somewhere. Wait a minute. He's coming in now. It's Jim Taylor. He wants to know who you're having an affair with.
Hello, Jim. What's doing? Jim, we've been through this before. If you're gonna have benches out in front of your store, people are gonna wanna sit on them. Well, I don't like him either, but I'm not gonna come over there and tell him to move. I'll do my best to Denise. Bye.
Well, whoever she is, she sure likes to read a lot.
Virginia, I'm flattered that you think I've got that much energy. I figured that if I can't find Paul Sheldon, at least I can find out what he wrote about.
What do you expect to find? A story about a guy who drove his car off a cliff in a snowstorm?
You see, it's just that kind of sarcasm that's given our marriage real spice.
Paul's sitting at the living room table, which has been set out for an intimate dinner. Annie comes in, obviously having made an effort on her appearance.
I hope you like it.
It looks wonderful. So do you.
Oh.
They both unfold their napkins and place them on their laps. She watches him as he struggles a little to eat his food with his good hand.
I've never had meatloaf this good. What do you do to it?
My secret is I only use fresh tomatoes, never canned. And to give it that little extra zip, I mix in some Spam with the ground beef.
Ah.
Can't get this in a restaurant in New York.
They both eat their food.
Let's have a toast.
A toast?
Yes, to Misery. Let me pour you some wine.
He pours himself a glass of wine. The children
carousel to Misery. The chestnut trees,
the wishing well. Wait. Let's do this right. Do you have any candles?
Oh, I don't know.
I think so. I'll go look.
She goes, and he pours the powder from the tablets into her wine.
Did you study decorating, or do you just have a flair?
Oh, you. I just picked things up over the years.
Well, certainly says you.
You really think so?
Oh, absolutely. Listen, if you can't find any, it's okay. I just thought it'd be nice.
Are you kidding? If anyone had ever told me that one day I'd be having a candlelit dinner with Paul Sheldon in my own house, I would have checked both legs to see which one was being pulled. Will this do?
It's perfect. To Misery and to Annie Wilkes, who brought her back to life.
Oh, Paul, I get goosebumps every time I think about it. Oh my God, what have I done? Oh, I'm so sorry, Paul. I ruined your beautiful toast. Oh. Will you ever forgive me? Here, let me pour another one.
He stares at her spilt wine, soaking into the tablecloth.
Can we pretend this never happened? To Misery.
To Misery.
Paul's typing furiously as he starts chapter 5. Later that day, Annie's reading the manuscript with Misery the pig curled up beside her. Buster's at home, sitting by the fire and reading one of the Misery books. Another day. Sunlight beams through the windows as Paul starts chapter 12.
Paul, this is positively the best Misery you've ever written.
He works late into the night and through to the next morning. The typewriter up and raises it above his head, trying to strengthen his arms. He plowed through chapter 28 and on to 35. Days pass and his bruises heal as he continues the book. As rain pours down outside, Paul's exercising with the typewriter. Annie comes in, looking depressed.
Here's your pills.
Annie? Annie, what is it?
The rain. Sometimes it gives me the blues. When you first came here, I only loved the writer part of Paul Sheldon. But now I know I love the rest of him, too. I know you don't love me. Don't say you do. You're a beautiful, brilliant, famous man of the world, and I'm not a movie star type. You'll never know the fear of losing.
Why would you lose me?
She shifts her gaze from him.
The book's almost finished. Your legs are getting better. Soon you'll be wanting to leave.
Why would I leave? I like it here.
That's very kind of you. But I'll bet it's not altogether true.
He swallows anxiously under her piercing stare. Her eyes lower and she draws a handgun from the pocket of her dressing gown. He gazes at it fearfully.
I have this gun.
She pulls the trigger, but the chamber's empty.
Sometimes I think about using it.
She meets his timorous gaze with a maniacal, glazed expression.
I better go now. I might put bullets in it.
She shuffles out and Paul sags despondently. Annie steps out onto the porch and locks the door behind her. Paul glances towards the window. She walks through heavy rain with lightning flashing around her. He's able to watch her station wagon, caught in a lightning flash, trundling off along the drive. Now he's reaching for a long, sharp knife in the kitchen. Having successfully taken it, he hauls himself back to his wheelchair by the door. Buster's engrossed in another misery book.
There is a justice higher than that of man. I will be judged by him.
What?
They're hauling misery into court.
That's nice.
He and Virginia are reading in bed. Buster gets a piece of paper and makes a note.
There is a justice higher than that of man. I will be judged by him.
Paul's wheeling himself back along the hall to his room when something catches his eye on a desk in the room ahead. Inside a scrapbook is a newspaper clipping bearing the headline, Paul Sheldon presumed dead, missing author's car found buried in snow. He lifts the book onto his lap. Another clipping begins, Where is Paul Sheldon? The scrapbook's entitled Memory Lane. He flicks through pages of photos and keepsakes from Annie's life. Another clipping has the headline, Local investment banker dies. Carl Wilkes plunges to his death. A Father's Day card is stuck in below it. A few pages on, his frown hardens with his discovery of the headline, Top nursing student falls to her death, and then another reading, Annie M. Wilkes garners nursing school honours. Flicking on, he discovers articles cataloguing a distinguished nursing career. She even headed an intensive care unit. Amongst further memorabilia, clippings disclose a veteran paediatrician dies while in coma at local hospital, and beside this, another about Wilkes named County's head maternity nurse. With growing concern, Paul reads the headline, Baby Lucy dies after 5 weeks struggle in hospital, and then second newborn death at Eldridge County Memorial. Later, he reads that a nurse was questioned over the infant's death. A larger article bears the headline, Infant deaths return to hospital's nursery ward. Paul flicks on. To a picture of Annie under the headline, Maternity Nurse Behind Bars, Dragon Lady Arrested in Recent Baby Deaths. He wheels himself back into his room and closes the door behind him. Paul's lying in bed with his injured arm in a sling over his chest. He shifts about and then suddenly rehearses brandishing the knife from his sling. He covers it up and practices again. Content with his speed, he resets the blade and sling and gazes out at the nighttime deluge. The house in the still of night. Patches of snow reflect pale moonlight. Paul's lying in bed with his arms resting above the covers. Headlights streak across his room as a car pulls up outside. He checks his sling anxiously and, with an air of uncertainty, rests his good arm at his side. His breathing quickens, and he reassures his grasp on the knife. A slit of light at the bottom of the door reveals a figure stopping in the hallway on the other side. He stares at the door handle in anticipation. But the figure moves on, and he tracks the sound. With a morbid sense of relief, he untucks the covers of the bed, removes the knife from the sling, and slips it under the mattress. He then pulls the covers back over himself, and with a look of grim determination...
See you in the morning.
As Paul sleeps, outside, the storm has rallied. Stirring from his slumber, Paul wearily opens his eyes. Annie's standing over him. She grabs his arm and injects something into it. Within seconds, the serum takes hold and he loses consciousness again. With a stoic expression, she paces out of the room. Clouds scudding over a snowy mountainscape. Paul rouses.
I'm supposed to lead into the finale of my show right now, but I'm having such a wonderful time and I have no other
Paul. Place to go.
After a moment, he reorientates himself.
I know you've been out.
He looks down to discover he's now tied to the bed with rope.
What?
You've been out of your room.
No, I haven't.
Paul, my little ceramic penguin in the study always faces due south.
I don't know what you're talking about. Ceramic penguin.
Is this what you're looking for?
The knife.
I know you've been out twice, Paul. First, I couldn't figure out how you did it. But last night, I found your key.
Her reshaped hair clip.
I know I left my scrapbook out. I can imagine what you might be thinking of me. But you see, Paul, it's all okay. Last night, it came so clear. I realized you just need more time. Eventually, you'll come to accept the idea of being here. Paul, do you know about the early days at the Kimberley Diamond Mines? Do you know what they did to the native workers who stole diamonds? Don't worry, they didn't kill them. That would be like junking a Mercedes just because it had a broken spring. No, if they caught them, they had to make sure they could go on working. But they also had to make sure they could never run away. The operation was called hobbling.
She reaches down and places a wooden block between his ankles. His brow furrows with mounting concern.
Annie, whatever you're thinking about doing, please don't do it.
She lifts a sledgehammer and walks to one side of the bed.
Annie, for God's...
Shh, darling. Trust me.
God's sake.
It's for the best.
Annie, please!
Almost done. Just one more.
She crushes the other ankle. And pants with morbid ecstasy.
God, I love you.
He convulses in agony. A slush-covered road at the base of a mountain. Annie's car cruises along it and takes a right at a junction. Buster's reading a newspaper, but looks out a window when Annie brakes to avoid crashing into a car that pulls out. He chuckles as she accelerates around the vehicle, then steps out onto his porch to watch her pull up. The other driver yells out.
Quit on this!
You poop!
He quietly observes Annie march into a nearby store. Then his thoughtful frown deepens. Virginia's doing a mountain of paperwork when he comes back in.
All right.
Oh, I like that tone.
How many times do I have to tell you? I have a system here. What the hell is that thing?
What thing?
The thing. There it is, right where it's supposed to be.
What is it?
Well, I'm not sure. Maybe nothing.
Well, I'm glad you found it.
There's that spice again.
Having grabbed his jacket and left with a note, he's now going through newspaper records at a library. He puts one tome aside and starts leafing through another. The article headed "Infant Deaths Return to Hospital's Nursery Ward" draws his attention. A few pages on, he discovers the photo of Annie taken when she was arrested. Another article leads with "Dragon Lady Claims Innocence," and under a photograph of her runs the caption, "Wilkes told reporters on courthouse steps, there is a justice higher than that of man. I will be judged by him." The note of the Misery novel quote he made the other night is identical. Annie arrives home. In his room, Paul sits dejectedly in his wheelchair, staring at the casts around his broken ankles.
Come on, Lizzie. Come on. Hi, Pumpkin.
He flicks her the bird.
Such a kidder. Come on, Misery.
The pig trots after her.
Come on, Lizzie.
Buster heads into the local store.
Hey, Pete. Answer me a couple of things.
If we can.
Do you have any new Paul Sheldon books?
Well, we had a batch. Sold them all out in 3 days.
You wouldn't happen to know if Miss Wilkes bought one of them, would you?
Are you kidding? Every time that fella writes a new book, she has me set aside the first copy.
Has she been buying anything odd lately?
Miss Wilkes? Same old stuff. Lest you call paper odd.
Newspaper?
No. Typing kind.
Well, that kind. Nothing odd about that.
Ms. Wilkes done something?
Not a thing.
Buster's in his weather-beaten police car and drives off a clear main road onto a snow-covered forest one. The sound of Buster's car draws Paul's attention, and he moves his wheelchair over to the writing desk that has been set up for him near the window. Paul squints as the car approaches from the distance. Suddenly, Annie comes at him with a syringe. Despite his struggles, she jabs the needle into his arm, and the fight gradually ebbs out of him. She prizes his hands from around her neck and hurriedly wheels him into the hall as Buster's police car draws closer.
I don't think I'll ever understand you. I cook your meals, I tend to you practically 24 hours a day, and you continue to fight me. When are we going to develop a sense of trust?
She's opened the door to a cellar. Buster parks up outside. Having carried Paul down into the cobweb-ridden cellar, she lays him on the floor. Buster's approaching the house on foot, and he quickly hurries into the hall and folds up the wheelchair. Reaching the porch, Buster crosses to the door.
Oh, my!
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to startle you, but you didn't give me a chance to knock.
I guess you can tell from my reaction I'm not all that used to visitors out here. What can I do for you?
Well, I was wondering, do you happen to know anything about Paul Sheldon?
What do you want to know?
Well, anything you could tell me might help.
Well, he was born in Worcester, Massachusetts, 45 years ago. The only child of Franklin and Helene Sheldon. Mediocre student, majored in history.
Well, that isn't exactly the kind of information I'm after. You see, he's been missing for...
of my Paul Sheldon collection.
I haven't invited you in. Please.
Thank you.
Of course, you must know all about that horrible accident.
Mind if I take a look around?
Of course not. That accident almost killed me, too. I prayed when I heard the news. I got down on my knees and I begged for it not to be true. You're gonna laugh at what I'm about to say, but go ahead. I don't care. When I was praying, God told me to get ready.
Get ready for what?
To be his replacement. He gave so much pleasure to so many people. There's a shortage of pleasure on the planet these days, in case you hadn't noticed. God told me, since I was his number one fan, that I should make up new stories as if I was Paul Sheldon. So I went to town, and I bought a typewriter and paper to type on, the same kind Paul Sheldon used. And I turned the guest bedroom into a writing studio. Would you like to see it?
Sure.
It's right this way.
As they head for that room, in the cellar, Paul begins to stir from his drug-induced slumber.
I know how he wrote. The kinds of words he used, the wonderful stories he told. I spent the last 4 weeks trying to write like Paul Sheldon, but I can't do it right. I try and I try and I know all the words, but it's just not the same.
Well, maybe it takes a while to get the hang of it.
I could give you a couple of hundred pages of mine and you could tell me what you think.
I'm not much of a critic.
Well, I just thought. Oh, look at me. You'd think I'd never had a guest before. Would you like a nice hot cup of cocoa? Trouble. There's some already made.
She paces from the room. Buster glances out of the window.
Must get lonely living out here all by yourself.
Well, I always say if you can't enjoy your own company, you're not fit company for anyone else.
Well, you've got a point there.
He goes into the room again, then peers back into the hall. She does the same. Once he's sure she's no longer watching him, he ducks across the hall and moves quietly upstairs. Paul's arm flails woozily and falls against a barbecue. Upstairs, Buster opens a door and peers into the room beyond. Finding nothing of significance, he crosses the landing to another door. On the other side is a neatly laid out bedroom. He wanders into the middle of it and peers around with his hands on his hips. Annie appears in the doorway behind him and closes in.
Here you are.
Oh, thanks, Miss Wilkes, but I don't want to take up any more of your time. I best be going.
But you didn't even taste your cocoa.
Well, I'm sure it's wonderful, but I really should be getting back.
In the cellar, the prostrate Paul knocks the barbecue feebly.
Well, if you wouldn't mind, perhaps I could pay you another visit sometime.
I'd be delighted now that you know the way.
She closes the door and her polite smile vanishes. Buster's about to leave when... Paul's toppled the barbecue over.
Miss Wilkes? Miss Wilkes, are you all right?
I'm down here!
Mr. Sheldon?
Buster's chest explodes, and as he falls, Annie's behind him with a smoking shotgun. She sets it aside and descends the cellar stairs.
Don't feel bad, Paul. It was bound to happen sooner or later. It's a sign. You see, I've known for some time why I was chosen to save you. You and I were meant to be together forever. But now our time in this world must end. But don't worry, Paul. I've prepared for what must be done. I put two bullets in my gun. One for you and one for me. Oh, darling, it'll be so beautiful.
She turns from him and plods back up into the hall. The moment she's gone, Paul looks around and spots a can of lighter fuel. But then Annie reappears with the gun and a syringe.
Now don't be afraid. I love you.
I love you too. And you're right. We are meant to be together. And I know we must die. But it must be so that misery can live. We have the power to give misery eternal life. We must finish the book.
But the time is now. Soon others will come.
It's almost finished. By dawn, we'll be able to give misery back to the world.
She takes a deep breath, but then turns and leaves. Paul grabs the can of lighter fuel and shoves it down the back of his trousers. Annie comes back with the wheelchair.
I'll fix you something to eat.
She leaves it at the top of the stairs. Paul's fingers dance over the typewriter, and even though the letter N doesn't print, he writes, "For 3 days and three nights, misery cried, certain that she would never..."
Oh, Paul, I'm dying. Does she wind up with Ian or Winthorne?
You'll know very soon. Just started the last chapter. You know, when I finish, I'd like everything to be perfect. I'll need three things.
What things?
You mean you don't know?
I was fooling, silly. You need a cigarette because you used to smoke, but you quit, except when you finish a book, and you have just one, and the match is to light it, and you need one glass of champagne. Dom Perignon.
Dom Perignon it is.
With her enchanted smile, she sweeps out of the room. The printer ribbon is fading badly now, but Paul types on.
Annie? Annie?
Yes, Paul.
I'm almost done.
Oh, Paul, this is so romantic. Ian and Winthorne dueling for the right to misery's hand. Does Ian win? Odo, tell me. It's Winthorne, right?
You'll know everything in a minute. Get the champagne.
Oh.
When she hurries away, Paul quickly grabs his stack of pages. Annie meticulously lays out the three things Paul requested on a tray. And then reaches for the gun, which she puts in her pocket, before carrying the tray through. Paul stops typing as she comes in and sets the tray on the end of his desk.
Did I do good?
You did perfect. Except for one thing. This time we'll need two glasses.
Oh, Paul.
When she heads out again, he quickly grabs the final page from the typewriter and wheels his legs out from under the table. He dumps the pages of the novel on the floor and scrunches the final sheet into a tinder stick. Then he takes the can of lighter fluid out of his trousers and douses the flammable substance over his creative work. He snatches the match from the tray just as Annie returns.
Remember how for all those years nobody knew who Misery's real father was? Or if they'd ever be reunited? It's all right here. Does she finally marry Ian? Or will it be Winthorne? It's all right here.
He strikes the match.
Paul, you can't!
Why not? I learn it from you.
No, 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 Misery!
her on the head with the typewriter. The arm of her blouse catches light and she desperately puts it out. She then lunges for him.
I'm gonna kill you, you lying cocksucker!
She bashes his head against the window, but then he forces his thumbs into her eyes and punches her. Fumbling for her gun, she gets off a shot before he can strike again. Despite getting shot in the shoulder, he plows into her. The final bullet goes astray, and she drops the gun to defend herself, eventually succeeding in rolling him onto his back. His punches weaken her, and he starts bashing her head against the floor.
You want it? You want it? Eat it! Eat it to your choke, you sick, twisted fuck!
Ramming ashes into her mouth, she knees his groin and gets up, but he trips her with his leg cast, and her head cracks against the typewriter. He glances at her body. There's a pool of blood around her head. Bruised and battered, he raises himself into a sitting position, swivels his broken legs around underneath him, and starts hauling his body towards the door along the wooden flooring. With immense effort, he starts across the hall. Annie's leapt on top of him. He bites her hand to get her off and then scrambles for the metal pig-shaped doorstop. His fingertips pull the pig over, and despite Annie wrestling him, he grabs it, swings it wildly at her head, and then rams the ornament into her face. She slumps forward onto him. He rolls her off. And pants heavily, sprawled out at the foot of the stairs. Eighteen months later. Paul makes his way along a bustling city sidewalk with the aid of a walking cane. Smartly dressed in a dark suit and tie, he enters a fancy-looking restaurant. Over dinner, The Higher Education of Philip Stone by Paul Sheldon.
This is it. Very first copy. The word I'm getting is the Times Review is going to be a love letter.
That'll be a first.
And my contacts at Time and Newsweek tell me they're both raves, and don't laugh. But for the first time, I think you've got a shot at some prizes.
Great.
I thought you'd be thrilled. You're being taken seriously.
I'm delighted the critics are liking it, and I hope the people like it too. But I wrote it for me. I don't think I'm completely nuts, but in some way, Annie Wilkes, that whole experience helped me.
Paul, since you brought her up, I have to ask you this, or I'll be drummed out of the agents' union. How would you feel about a nonfiction book about what went on in that house?
Gee, Marsh, if I didn't know you better, I think you were suggesting I dredge up the worst horror of my life just so we could make a few bucks.
Annie is a waitress.
I thought you were over it.
I don't know if anyone could ever totally get over something like that. It's weird. Even though I know she's dead, I still think about her once in a while.
Excuse me, I don't mean to bother you, but are you Paul Sheldon?
Yes.
I just want to tell you I'm your number one fan.
That's very sweet of you.
I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places that this heart of mine embraces. All day through, in that small cafe, the park across the way, the children's carousel, the chestnut trees the wishing well. I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day.